You want global trade? We got global trade, Davos style. Also, we got beer. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday today, 25 January. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. I know they call it the World Economic Forum, but really it's only about 3,000 of the rich and powerful, including, as you might have heard, President Trump. He's making a big speech tomorrow, about which more in a minute. But we are going to start with an interview the president did with CNBC today after getting to Davos, the topic of which was, among other things, global trade. The president said he prefers bilateral trade deals, us and one other country, but that he would be open to bigger treaties like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, that he pulled the United States out of a number of months ago. He'd be open to it if...
if we did a substantially better deal, I would be open to TPP.
The catch here is, of course, that the 11 Asia-Pacific countries still in the TPP came to an agreement this week without us. So that's a done deal. Deal-wise. Anna Swanson covers global trade for the New York Times. She is with us every now and again on a Friday for our weekly wrap. We got her today, though, in Montreal, where the NAFTA negotiations are going on. Anna, it's good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
So the president, as you heard there, may or may not get into the TPP, setting aside for a minute that deal is actually now officially done. As you sit there at the NAFTA talks, where do you think the international community is on the United States and its seriousness with which it approaches global trade?
Yeah, so I think this is a really big moment. This deal that was built largely by the United States, moving on without it. And of course, President Trump criticized this as a bad deal, but it means that countries like Japan, Australia, Canada, Mexico all have cheaper access to each other's markets than American exporters do. I think other countries are, you know, hearing the Trump administration message that they are pushing back against this idea that America First is isolationist. But if you talk to officials and business people from other countries, that's how these moves are being interpreted.
Right. The president also on CNBC today in that interview said, you know, I love bilateral deals, he said. You get better deals. And he says he's working on a bunch of them. Do we know what bilateral deals the Trump administration is working on?
We don't. It's hard to say who they're talking about. So Japan at first was their likely choice, but Japan appeared to have declined that offer, saying that the U.S. is welcome to return to the TPP at any time, but it prefers that to a bilateral deal. And the U.K. is also, you know, a pretty logical partner, mm-hmm. but it's really wrapped up in Brexit at the moment. So there could be some Asian countries that they're looking at, but we don't know for sure. And meanwhile, you have to think that other countries are watching this very tough approach the administration is taking to renegotiating NAFTA. Right. And they have to be a little bit wary of jumping into a one-on-one negotiation with a tough partner.
Let me ask you a question about, I guess, appearances, right? You had Secretary Mnuchin yesterday saying he is in favor of a weaker dollar in terms of trade because that will help American exporters. At the same time, you have the Trump administration raising tariffs, as we've talked about on this program, on solar and washing machines. What signal does that send to potential American trading partners?
I think it's kind of a mixed signal. You know, I mean, it's clear that the United States wants to protect its domestic market and do a better job of preserving the U.S. market for American producers. The tariffs, you know, they could protect manufacturers of these products from some imports and help to bolster some manufacturing, but they have a lot of other perhaps unintended consequences, yeah. Like the tariff on solar cells and modules could really hit solar installation and solar power, which has been a growing industry in the United States.
Anna Swanson covers global trade for the New York Times. We got her in Montreal, where she's at the NAFTA talks. Anna, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Couple other things global trade news-wise that we need to touch on today. First of all, something you might call the presidential walk back. You remember yesterday all the time that we spent on this program on Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin having said he wants to see a weak dollar? That, and I'm quoting here the full quote for context, obviously a weaker dollar is good for us, the Treasury Secretary said, as it relates to trade and opportunities. Well, in that CNBC interview, President Trump changed his Treasury Secretary's mind for him.
I think they were taken out of context because I read his exact statement. I'll tell you where I stand. which ultimately is very important. Number one, I don't like talking about it because, frankly, nobody should be talking about it. It should be what it is. It should also be based on the strength of the country. We are doing so well. Our country is becoming so economically strong again, and strong in other ways, too, by the way, that the dollar is going to get stronger and stronger. And ultimately, I want to see a strong dollar.
What usually happens with dollar policy, by the way, for presidents and treasury secretaries alike, is that they talk strong dollar while everybody knows that what they secretly want is a not quite so strong currency, and everybody just kind of plays along. President Trump is going to close the Davos festivities with a speech tomorrow, as I said, the first by a sitting American president at the World Economic Forum in 18 years. Thought it might be interesting, just for some context ahead of that news, to play a quick piece of sound from the last such speech, Bill Clinton, January 2000, up in Davos, 18 years and a very long time ago.
In a few days, we will have the longest economic expansion in the history of the United States. I am convinced one of the reasons that it will happen is that we have kept our markets open, even in tough times, so that there has always been pressure to keep inflation down as we continue to generate jobs and growth.
That economic expansion President Clinton was talking about, by the way, 120-month, 10 years, if you do the math. This one that we're in the middle of now, 8.5 years, started in June 2009 after the Great Recession. Back on the home front today, the dollar rallied a bit on that presidential walk back. Stocks kind of bounced around. Oil, story on that coming up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so oil as promised. It's been, what, 3 years or so that oil stories have started with crude prices today were a bit soft. That was me imitating myself, by the way. Anyway, they are soft no more, oil prices. The global benchmark Brent crude topped 70 bucks today. Gas prices, in case it had escaped you, have been creeping up for a couple of years now. But supplies, we are told, are plentiful. So what's going on? Marketplace's Scott Tong explains from the Sustainability Desk. It starts with a healthy world economy.
The big economies in the world are chugging along. So there's more driving, more plane rides, more flush investors putting their money on oil. Here's Jamie Webster at the Boston Consulting Group.
The global economy is booming. There's very few countries that are not expected to show economic growth this coming year. And of course, the big guy, of course, OPEC, has kept their barrels off the market.
And that's the supply part of the picture, which is tightening. OPEC and Russia and others have renewed their collective deal to pump less. Then there's what's called supply risk, instability in certain petrostates that might not be able to get their barrels to market, which also pushes prices up, says Amy Myers Jaffe at the Council on Foreign Relations.
To the extent that people look around the world and it looks unstable in the Middle East, and you have the Iran nuclear deal with the United States still sort of in the balance, you've got this deteriorating situation in Venezuela, it's hard to think about the price of oil going back down.
So now we have a debate in the oil patch. Price optimists think demand will keep outrunning supply to the tune of 80, even 100 bucks a barrel. Others predict U.S. drillers will go on a fracking binge and bring more supply to the world. And that's how Bob McNally at Rapidan Energy sees it.
To paraphrase St. Augustine, Lord, make me holy, but not yet. My approach is, Lord, make me bullish, but not yet, right? I see oil prices here at $70 is not sustainable.
Because more U.S. oil would push today's price back down. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We've got another couple of weeks before Congress and the president are really going to concentrate on immigration. Their self-imposed deadline, the government funding limit, is the 8th of February. In the meanwhile, immigration enforcement continues apace. Earlier this month, ICE agents raided nearly 100 7-Eleven stores all across the country. 21 people were arrested. Managers were given audit notices and 3 days to provide documentation that their workers were in the country legally. It was the biggest set of raids against a single company since the president has been in office. And as Marketplace's Rima Kreis reports, there are almost certainly more of the same coming.
One 7-Eleven that was targeted by ICE agents is in Koreatown, a heavily Latino and Asian neighborhood in Los Angeles, crowded with shops, karaoke bars, and all-you-can-eat Korean barbecue. Just days after the raid, Jose Eduardo Sanchez, armed with a tote bag of glossy brochures, visited many of those businesses, looking to speak with managers.
We're trying to talk to Korean business owners, Latino business owners, in terms of what to do if they are confronted with ICE at work.
Sanchez is with the Koreatown Immigrant Workers Association, a nonprofit. And tonight, it's his colleague, Du Kong, who's doing most of the talking in Korean. Kong tells owners about the nearby 7-Eleven raids. They're all well aware. And he explains that no matter who their employees are, managers need to understand their rights in case ICE agents show up.
The most important rule, and if I could say this 1,000 times in one conversation, I will, is that you have the right to remain silent.
Sanchez also advises employers to have a plan, identifying a point person, a possible exit strategy, and to go over it with employees, like a fire drill. Next stop, El Pollo Loco, a popular fast food restaurant.
It's another chain. It's another restaurant that's very common in immigrant communities. So could that be a potential target?
Even business owners who are a lot less visible were rattled by the 7-Eleven sweep. Melanie runs a housekeeping business in Southern California. She doesn't want to disclose her last name for fear of being targeted. She has 14 workers.
And I think that it maybe even makes our team feel a little bit safer because it would really have to be a house-to-house sort of investigation to try to find anybody that works with us right now.
Still, she says,
places, communities that we thought were safe for all immigrants and basically all people really aren't.
Our goal is if you are illegally in the United States, that you need to leave.
Matthew Allen is an assistant director with ICE's Homeland Security Investigations Unit.
The enforcement operation that happened on January 10th will not be the last one that you hear about in 2018.
And hearing about it, sending a message, getting on the local news is pretty much the point.
Part of our job is to create that deterrent effect. But I also want to make it clear that we're trying to impact not only employers, but even employees and people who are thinking about coming to the United States.
When ICE agents show up at a business, they don't always make arrests. They may just serve audit notices requiring documentation. Employers who are found to have hired undocumented immigrants can face steep fines. But Michael Wishney, a professor at Yale Law School, says it can be hard, at times impossible, to prove that employers knew someone's papers were fake. And fines can usually be whittled down.
I think most employers experience these as sort of a slap on the wrist, a kind of occasional annoyance, but rarely anything meaningful.
He says the last time large-scale workplace raids made headlines was under President George W. Bush. Agents rounded up hundreds of workers at meatpacking plants, factories, and farms. But business leaders pressured politicians to dial it back, something that could easily happen again, says Wishney.
And eventually, the local pushback tends to lead the administration to fall back. So there's these sort of ebbs and flows.
Even so, immigrant advocates say that undocumented workers are already afraid to speak up.
And to any worker who has just seen ICE raid a bunch of businesses, they're going to be a lot more worried about actually reporting wage theft.
Casey Raymond is a lawyer with the nonprofit BetZedek. He helps undocumented workers file claims when they're not being paid minimum wage or given required breaks. He says he's seen a rise in cases of workers who confront their bosses only to be threatened flat out with being reported to ICE. Or more subtly,
oh, so where are you from again? Or they'll start asking a lot of questions about country of origin.
Raymond says for some employers, raids embolden them to further silence workers. Workers who often say they can't afford to pick up their bags and go. I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace.
Coming up,
you have this extraordinary growth in employment, despite the fact that this is a 200-year-old industry, so it's rare for something like that to happen.
Beer, the economics thereof. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 140 today, about a half percent, finished at 26,392. Did the blue chips. NASDAQ dropped 3 points, less than a 10%, 74.11. S&P 500, call it flat, 28.39. Heavy equipment maker Caterpillar crawled up 0.6% today, posted better than expected fourth quarter earnings. Sales up 35% on strong global demand for construction and mining machinery. Transportation firms rolled a bit lower. Union Pacific slid 5.3% today and worse than expected fourth quarter profits. FedEx down 0.8%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell just a touch, 2.62%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We talked housing and the financial crisis yesterday on the program with the CEO of the mortgage giant, Fannie Mae. If you happen to have missed it, by the way, it is on our daily podcast that we do. The interview was part of our year-long coverage of the 10th anniversary of the near collapse of the American economy. Divided decade, we're calling it. 10 years ago this week, the American housing market posted its biggest year-over-year drop since 1973. The housing crisis was in full effect. The spillovers into the financial system were coming. And even though we didn't know it at the time, we were already then a month into the Great Recession. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore takes us back to the days that led up to it all.
The housing crisis, in many ways, started in people's heads. You could say in their hearts, however you want to say it. As this century began, people felt great about housing.
Oh, it was so hot.
Heidi Kasama is a longtime realtor in Las Vegas and president of the Nevada Realtors Association.
Literally, I remember one time I was entering a listing into the computer and the phone rang, I'm not kidding, less than a minute after I hit enter, and somebody asked me, is it still available? That's how frantic people were.
Home prices were rising really fast and had been for years. Chris Bishop is also a realtor. He heads the Greater Las Vegas Association of Realtors. He'd just begun his career back in 05.
All of the market reports, all of the media coverage, everything was talking about how great the real estate market was, what a great opportunity it was. You know, if you're not doing it, you should be. And everyone was investing in real estate. Literally every person I knew.
People's feelings, their enthusiasm, created something almost like a collective hallucination, but one that felt very real.
Delinquencies were extremely low.
Mark Willis is senior policy fellow at NYU's Furman Center. Delinquencies were low because whenever someone couldn't afford their mortgage payments, they could just sell the house and make their mortgage back and then some. Lenders, banks, financial institutions, they noticed that.
And because there were fewer and fewer defaults early in the 2000s, mortgage lenders became more and more liberal.
Standards got pretty lax because, in a way, the banks were caught up in this same collective illusion. Lenders didn't always require proof of income or documentation. People lied on 10 to 15% of mortgage applications, according to Chris Mayer, professor of real estate at Columbia Business School.
And so the lack of diligence meant that people were making, you know, giving loans to anybody who walked in the door and wanted them.
Heidi Kasama remembers asking one buyer, why did you buy this second home?
And he goes, you know, honestly, I was just driving by and the new home builder flags were flapping in the wind and they said, you can buy this home, no money down. And he said, basically, kind of before I knew it, I purchased a home because I didn't need anything. I didn't need proof of income. They said the lender would put it together.
The amount of residential mortgage debt in the U.S. doubled between 2000 and 2008. Andy Howitt is a research economist and senior vice president at the New York Fed.
Mortgage credit flowing to people who controlled multiple properties got to be nearly half of all mortgage credit flowing at the peak. So there was a lot of money going to people who were extremely optimistic about prices.
And of course, as we all know, those prices did not keep rising. Around 2006, prices started to fall. And the quickest to get into the housing market were the quickest to get out.
As prices started to turn, they exacerbated the downward cycle by dumping properties on the market quickly and in large numbers.
The same mania that drove prices up started driving them down.
You would drive through neighborhoods and everyone had a for rent or for sale sign. I mean, everybody. It was crazy to see.
Realtor Chris Bishop. Bad mortgages set off a chain reaction through the financial system, triggering the Great Recession. People started losing their jobs. More people couldn't pay their mortgages.
Las Vegas was what they, you know, they literally called it the epicenter for foreclosures. And it wasn't like, you know, it was just a few people in the neighborhood. I don't care who you are. Everyone was dealing with it. Either you were affected or a family member was affected or a friend was affected. Everyone had something.
Heidi Kasama remembers abandoned homes were just everywhere.
I call it the brown lawn syndrome, that when you would drive through these communities, they were just parched lawns all over throughout communities. So it just, it looked awful. It looked like a bomb went off.
These days, things are a lot different. The percentage of seriously underwater homeowners nationally has fallen from 31.4% in 2012 to about 10% today. Foreclosures are at an 11-year low. Banks are more regulated, lenders more careful about handing out loans. Even Las Vegas has a thriving real estate market now, says Christopher Bishop.
We feel like we can breathe again.
And the mania of the 2000s is a memory. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Divided Decade is the name of our year-long project, The Financial Crisis and How It Changed Us. Tell us on Instagram. We are at Marketplace APM using the hashtag how we changed. A pause now for a libation, or at least a pause for a conversation about my personal libation of choice, a good chewy craft beer. Somehow, despite two ginormous international conglomerates controlling virtually all the beer production out there, the craft beer industry still somehow survives and thrives. And the best part of this is that it's actually a no-joke economic story, not just me wanting to talk about beer. Derek Thompson wrote about craft beer and its successes in the Atlantic. Derek, it's good to have you.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So beer consumption overall is down. Some of the biggies are selling less. Yet craft beer is not only staying afloat, it is doing well. How is that happening?
It's doing fantastically well. I was sort of rooting around in government data and realized that something really weird happened in the last decade. Between 2008 and 2016, the number of brewery establishments expanded by a factor of six. It sextupled. Wow. And the number of brewery workers grew by more than 100%. It more than doubled. So what we're looking at is the craft beer revolution, which anyone who's frequented a bar sometime in the last 5 or 10 years clearly understands is so huge that it's having an enormous effect at the sort of government data level in terms of employment and establishments. And it's a really sort of interesting story because you have this extraordinary growth in employment despite the fact that this is a 200-year-old industry. So it's rare for something like that to happen.
Exactly. It is perhaps the definition of a mature industry. What is going on here?
So there's a lot of things that seem to be going on. Beer is a very specific regulatory regime, a very specific regime that essentially separates producers from middlemen from retailers, a so-called three-tier system that is designed to explicitly make it difficult for vertical monopolies to occur. That is, for a company to own the production and distribution and retailing of a product. And so in an industry like this, where the regulatory regime makes it hard for one company to own everything, it makes it more likely for something like the craft beer revolution to happen, for 1,000 flowers to bloom at the local level. And that's precisely what we're seeing.
And so what we're talking about here is these local tap houses where I can go in and get a growler of whatever my favorite locally produced brew is, right? That's the distribution channel that we're talking about here.
It is. And what's interesting about tap rooms that you just mentioned is that tap rooms actually allow really small brewers to sell their beer directly. The regulatory environment is such that they've made it difficult for the big guys to sell directly while allowing exceptions at the state level for, you know, Kai's IPA, Derek's Sour, to open a tap room and serve people who come right by. So that allows our fledgling little beers to develop a local fandom and then grow a little bit. And then once we reach a certain level, then it becomes illegal for us to sort of bypass this three-tier system.
Brief side note here. We actually bandied about the idea of developing a marketplace Kai PA. That's a true story. Never went anywhere.
But that's right.
I mean, come on, it's almost too easy. Let me throw a word at you here, though, and get your reaction. Bearing in mind that not too long ago, we were hearing tales of tripling of hop prices and hops being off the market, hop being the key ingredient in some of those good new craft beers. The word I want to run by you here is bubble.
Mm. Well, on the one hand, I've talked to a lot of people who know the craft beer industry a lot better than I do, and they do think that we are nearing the peak of this craft beer bubble. So if you are looking to get into that market, Mr. Kai PA, then you should definitely do it now rather than wait for the bubble to burst and start your business on the other side of it. That said, 2016 was probably the best year in American history for employment at breweries, and 2017 appears to be right about on track to match it. So it really looks like things are still accelerating, or at least were through the first half of 2017.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, writing about beer. Derek, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, a commentary of sorts, I suppose, on what divides us. The good people at Morning Consult, they do online surveys and market research. They've asked around about which brand names are viewed most unfavorably by people, broken down by political affiliation of those people. So for Democrats, it's Trump hotels going away. For Republicans, the NFL and CNN are in a dead heat. Here, though, is the one that got me scratching my head. Independents, their most unfavorably rated brand, Diet Pepsi. What's up with that? All right, we are out of here. The Dow Industrial is up about 140 points today, 0.5% or so. Everything else basically flat. John Buckley, Deirdre Dedepke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Troe are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. It's true. Kai PA. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.